everybody. This is Armand Demel with you with The Positive Mind here on WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial, bringing you ideas, concepts, and guests to help you lead a more positively minded life. Hey, focus on jobs. Focus on work. Focus on what it is to be out there nowadays, trying to keep your head above water in the job world. So I brought in a special guest, Nick Papadopoulos. Nick teaches people about work. He gives lectures, coaches personally, and basically he's spent his life helping people get jobs, perform at jobs, keep jobs, get advanced. And he teaches corporations how to keep their employees happy as well. Let me introduce Nick. Nick, welcome to BAI.
Hi, Armand. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Nick. So what do you do? And I'm going to do this because I believe that we could give people some good information. Also in the studio with us, Linda Vanell, as usual. Hi, Linda.
Hi, Armand.
Okay, exciting. Exciting because it's tough out there. It's tough if you don't know what you're doing to shoot yourself in the foot. And I know people who do that all the time.
Right. So what do? I will work with individuals and, as you mentioned, teams at companies and support them in their communication, in their relationships, how they show up at work, and empower them with the tools, the skills, and insight to further their careers, either at the company or if they're looking for a new opportunity.
Let's talk about show up.
Okay.
How they show up, because I know that you, as a leader, have used this phrase quite a bit.
Right.
How you show up. What does that mean?
Well, show up can be physically how you show up, right? Do you show up in what I refer to as excellence? How you show up emotionally, mentally as well. Do you show up, or what's your intention when you show up? Is your intention to do good work? Is your intention to have a meaningful, empowering conversation? Are you showing up as someone who wants to land that interview and, you know, progress in your career?
So showing up, is the word show is kind of important here. It means how others perceive you when you present yourself.
Correct.
Right? Now, is it your attitude that's about what you're showing up, or is it about how they see you? Because if you can make yourself look really cool, maybe people will believe you're better than you are.
Right. I'd say it starts with attitude, the mental part. What's your intention? What's your vision for that meeting, for that interview, for that relationship, for that conversation? So I do believe it starts there, and then that will show up, again, using that term, in the way that you may dress, in the words that you use or don't use, the way that you may conduct the conversation, even the attitude drives everything.
Well, you know, if most attitudes nowadays are, please give me the job, please give me the job. I'm scared. I'm afraid I can't make it. I'm afraid you're not going to value me. Please give me what I need here. please be somebody who values me. Now, That's what the real feeling is.
Right.
But you can't put that out there. You can't go out there and say to a boss, please, I need this job desperately.
Correct.
So you're saying that you have to put on your attitude has to be a different presentation than your weakness.
Right. And instead of using the word attitude, I use the term ways of being.
Okay.
What are your ways of being when you show up? Are you enthusiastic? Are you clear? Are you present? Are you feeling abundant? To your point, if you're coming across as desperate, people will sniff that out immediately, and that tends to be a turnoff.
So you have to hide your desperation.
Absolutely, but the best way to hide it is to really get focused on that there are an abundance of opportunities, that you are worthy of opportunities, and that they're out there. This is not the end-all, be-all conversation or interview, that there's going to be more. This is part of the process in learning about yourself. I mean, I look at every interview or every conversation and say, okay, regardless of what happens, I get a chance to learn about myself, what I like or dislike, you know, confirm that this is the type of company or environment I want to be in or not. So I look at it as a gift, each of these conversations, rather than, oh my gosh, I hope I enroll this person in hiring me today.
You know, when I was a kid, we had a process that we used. The New York Times was the only way that people found jobs. And of course, the New York Times has so many jobs located on it that you could cut off. If you cut into one page, you're going to get me missing something on the other page if you cut out a job. So what we did, which was fascinating, and part of the way I was trained by somebody who helped me, is we took the New York job at Times and we cut out every job that we could possibly do, which could include washing floors, which could include being a pope. It could be anything, whatever they threw in the New York Times. I don't think they were advertising pope at the time. But anyway, so you cut out many jobs and there would be like hundreds, thousands that you could do, that you can do.
Right.
And we built a triangle. So since we used two newspapers, you could do the other side. See, so you could have them all. And then we were encouraged to build a triangle from the base all the way up to the top job we would like, right? You're going to be pope. The second two jobs, okay, I'll be president or I'll be this. And then you work your way all the way down to the very bottom where there are thousands of jobs, hundreds of jobs that you may not want to do, like cleaning toilets and stuff like that. But you know you could do it. And this gave us a very different attitude, saying to us of what you're saying, hey, there is abundance there. There is something there.
Right.
So realizing that there is something is a very important thing, and not going in there with a defeatist attitude.
Absolutely. I have a client that I was working with recently, and one of the exercises I did with him, which I did with others, is it's really simple. I just say, if a genie appeared before you, what would you wish for? What would be the characteristics of the ideal dream career opportunity? And we come up with about 12 different characteristics, everything from location to how far you want to commute or don't want to commute, how much money you want to make, the type of people you want to work around, and so on and so on. And it's really amazing that when you get locked in on those characteristics, that's what becomes important rather than, did Armand, the interviewer, call me back in time? Or, you know, he didn't smile at me three times during the interview. What you're getting really locked in is this abundance that opportunity really does exist out there. And it's actually very empowering because you let go of how it's, you know, how you think it's supposed to go. And instead you just lock in on this dream opportunity. And I bring this person up because he landed his dream opportunity. And what's interesting, the company did not actually have a job advertised in the New York Times next to the Pope or on a Monster or any place else. He just decided, this is the place I want to be because it fits my 12 characteristics. I'm telling the genie about it, and I'm going to send a letter and an email into someone and follow up with a phone call. And that's exactly what he did. He created an opportunity. So that's one of the things that's really important is not to get boxed in to, oh, company A doesn't have any jobs advertised, or I don't know anybody there. Again, get locked in. What is the dream job, and what characteristics are important to you?
Nick, you've got a tremendous amount to teach us. My guest is Nick Papadopoulos, and I'm going to be picking his brain for a little while here. Question for you. If a person is on unemployment,
right,
and getting their basic minimum wage, whatever it is that they get, on unemployment, and they look at that versus work, do you think being on unemployment makes it more difficult for you to show up and present yourself? Do you think having that thing to fall back on works against you?
You know, I'm going to answer it by saying, if you say so. Okay. If you say it's difficult, then it's difficult. I believe that you want to act as if you actually do have an opportunity, that you already are working, that you're comfortable and abundant already, so that when you approach these conversations, you avoid having that desperation that, you know, again, people sniff that out about you. You know, people talk about they hire on instinct or on their gut. Part of that is how are you showing up? Are you coming into the meeting acting desperate? I interviewed someone this very morning for one of my clients, and he would not stop talking. Even when I said, okay, the next steps will be that someone will call you back, he continued to talk. And I felt bad. I mean, I felt for him because I knew he really wanted me to connect with him and get him. At the same time, it did turn me off. It's you know, as a human being, it's hard for me to not notice that desperation. And then that makes me wonder, will that show up in his conversations with the clients, with the coworkers? You know, will that show up?
Yeah, there's only there are a couple of people who exploit that desperation. They find that desperation in people, and they put you on, you know, doing cold calls.
Correct.
And selling things on the, oh, good, here's a desperate person. But in general, the desperate person doesn't get much of a chance. Now, there are ways of observing, and you say you one of the things, one of the first parts of your series of teachings has to do with discovering personality types.
Right.
Do you mind if we go into that right now? I'd like to learn about that.
That'd be great.
These are personality types that you want to be able to identify in people that you meet or in yourself or both?
Both. Okay. So in as it relates to the people you meet, understanding what that other person may be, it allows you to then bring what may be needed by that person, or what I coin as wanted and needed. And you use the term personality. I like to use communication styles.
Okay.
That there are four different types of communication styles out there. Personality tends to box people in.
Sure.
It tends to have you view someone as they can never change. Communication style really just means they have a tendency to communicate a certain way, yet have access to all the other ways to communicate as well. And there's less judgment around communication style versus personality.
So a communication style that someone would have could be one of four ways.
And, correct.
And what would your four ways be that the person could be?
The first one is dominant. The second one is influential. The third one is steady. And the fourth one is conscientious.
Well, before we even ask people and give them definitions, in your communication style, which do you think you are? You think you're dominant? Or do you think you're being influential? Or steady? Or conscientious? Interesting choice. I'm sure I'm just plain old steady. Now, what are you?
There's a fifth one for you, actually.
What's yours?
Mine would be dominant.
You're dominant, too.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we should have good conversations.
Yeah.
So dominant conversations are great, aren't they?
They can be.
I mean, if they become competitive, it's brutal.
Correct. To your point, is it important for me coming to you in a communication, a relationship, to understand what my style is? So knowing that I'm dominant and knowing that you're dominant, I know what to bring, when to bring it, and what not to bring and when not to bring it.
Right, because if you want something from me,
right,
you might say, or if I want something from you, I may step back.
Correct.
And say, okay, I don't have to be dominant now. He's rowing the boat. It's his ship.
Correct.
Right?
Correct. Yeah, when you have two dominant people, generally, again, this is a generalization, both people want to be right. Both want to win. Okay? So in a negotiation, knowing that I'm dominant and you're dominant, if I want to sell you something at $10, I know that you need to negotiate down because that makes you feel important, makes you feel good. So I may give you actually a higher price, $13, $14, knowing you're going to negotiate me down to 11 or 10. Now we both won. I got you to buy. And by a 10, you feel like a champ because you got me down from 14. So that's the, again, it's a silly example, yet it's a very real one that allows us to both win.
What I really want to do is hire you.
Right.
You know what I mean? Then?
Right.
Right. If you're that good, I'm going to, I want to hire you.
Right.
Okay. So a dominant style, what is that dominant communicating style like?
They're in charge. They're decisive. They're the drivers. They're fast paced. They're very, what I would call bottom line. It could be blunt. When they get under pressure, they may become demanding. And then their extreme behavior is that they may get emotional, slam their fist on the desk. They may even leave. They're very demonstrative. They have a very loud personality or style, I should say.
Okay, so that's one. Now, you could recognize that in yourself.
Right.
And you could recognize it in the person you're talking to.
Correct.
So if we look around any room, Nick, would you be able to, without even hearing a person talk, know what their communication style is?
Absolutely.
So how do you know it? You know it by the way they show up? You know it by their clothing? You know it by their face?
Yes. All of the above. It's clothing. So someone with a dominant style generally dresses well. They usually wear the latest clothing. They're not flashy, but they dress very, very well. They're usually physically fit. You know, because they're the overachievers many times. Their desk is well organized. Because they have a big ego, generally, you'll see pictures in their office of, you know, the 15-pound or 15-foot shark that they just caught, you know, on their last trip in Cape Cod. So they're very egotistical. So you can kind of see that it shows up in their office. It's also the way they talk. They talk fast, to the point. They interrupt you. They can be controlling in that way. They want to control the conversation. So again, when you're interviewing in a job interview, instead of getting triggered that this person may not like you, or that because the conversation went faster than it usually does, or that you used to, doesn't mean the conversation went poorly. You can make the case it went right as it was supposed to.
Now, one of the things that dominants like to do is throw you a curveball and see how you react.
Correct.
And just because they throw a curve at you and you don't react well doesn't necessarily mean you lose.
Correct. Correct. Mm-hmm. In fact, they probably expect that you're not going to react well. So if you start to get flustered by that, that's where they start to view you as someone who may be hiding something.
Oh, I see. So it's really a test. It's a test for authenticity, right? Which now, authenticity is a big word to you, Nick. I know this. What does that mean? What is it? I know we may be even stepping away from the work here. What is authenticity to you? What's that about? Because I know personally this is what you strive for.
Right.
I want everybody to know that Nick is one of the people who I respect the most in the world because of his work on himself, as well as his work as a job. This is a man who has strived for the highest level of personal authenticity, right? And falls flat on his face a lot of the time. But he picks himself up, dusts himself off, and starts all over again. Authentic. Give me what that word means to you.
Well, thank you for that feedback.
Sure.
authentic means, loving your entire self, all parts of it, and being okay to show it, being okay to share it, bringing it all the time. Regardless of what others may think or say, regardless of how it may go against the grain, if you will, authentic is just tapping into your what I call your true self. It's expressing your true self it's more of a commitment, to be frank with you. It's a commitment to seeking the truth. It's an ongoing process. It's a journey. It's something that I strive for in showing myself. Again, I keep using the word showing, in my entirety, who I really am, and being okay with that, and knowing I'm going to fall flat on my face, knowing that some or many may not agree or disagree or whatever the case may be, but just being okay with that.
When you take that and you try to apply that to somebody who is new at getting jobs, for example, you're trying to say to them, on one level, be authentic.
Right.
But not if you're going to cry.
Right. 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 I believe authenticity, I use the term ways of being. When you're interviewing or when you're gainfully employed and you're in a workplace, I actually do believe authenticity is one of the key ways of being. Sharing who you are, providing, input or your feedback from an authentic place, I think is really, really important. Because if you don't do that, you run the risk of later on folks thinking of you or having misinformation about who you are and have a different expectation. So if you say, I'm great at managing people, right? And you have no experience managing people. You have very little, but you design your resume in a way that bloats that feature about your personality. Well, it's going to come back to haunt you, because if they really want you to manage people and you haven't, well, being inauthentic during the interview process is only going to be a short-lived job for you, because they're going to find out within a couple of weeks that this isn't the right fit. So I do believe, what you see is really what you're going to get. What you say is really what you're going to get.
And the goal in life, my goal in life, is to be who I am.
Right.
My goal in life is no lies. That's just the way it is. This is the way I am. Here I am. If you could use it and get along with it, fine. If you can't, that's fine too.
Right. Right.
So how would you describe an influential communication style? Is that what I'm doing now? Am I doing the influential communication style?
The influential is the person who is persuasive, they're enthusiastic, they're high energy. There's a promoter piece in them. They're the energizer bunny. Under pressure, they may start to oversell. They may even manipulate a little. That's where they become, they can tend to become inauthentic when they're not getting their way. In an extreme behavior, they, like the dominant, can become emotional. But as opposed to leaving, they might just pout. They might just get really upset.
How do you tell the difference between a dominant and an influential style if they're both selling?
There's actually quite a bit of similarity between the two because they both have a large presence. The influential is more of the charmer, and I mean this in a way that mm-hmm. you know the positive. They're the high energy. They're more of a high energy, very very social. They tend to talk for a long time. They like to tell stories. You also can tell their offices generally have themes in them. So when I was living in Colorado, for example, because I've got some influential style in me as well, when I lived in Colorado, my whole office had New York Yankee paraphernalia, pictures. I had the hat out on my desk. You knew that in Boulder, Colorado, there's someone from New York City who's a Yankee fan, right? Mm-hmm. That's very much the promoter. I want everyone to notice me. So they're probably a little louder than the dominant type. They're also more of they like team. You know, the dominant person wants to go about it alone. They're more independent, whereas the influential person looks to rally the troops.
So an influential person would be a great manager. You know, if you're the boss, you'd like to have somebody who communicates through influentiality.
There is a challenge. The answer would be yes and no. Mm-hmm. They're great because they are team and they can be very consensual. If they want to make a decision, they're bringing everyone together. They'll include everyone. They definitely will decorate the office really festively during the holidays, which is all great for a culture. They tend to want to be liked. So that's one of the things you can also notice about an influential person, their need for approval.
That becomes difficult as a manager.
Correct. So that's where it can get in their way. Again, going back to one of the original points we made, that's why it's really important to notice what style you're bringing to a situation.
And what Nick, this is Nick Papadopoulos, and we're talking about work and work coaching. And so far what you're saying is that we all have these four styles.
Right.
It's just one of them is more than another because I'm influential, I'm dominant, I'm steady, and I'm conscientious. Let's talk about steady. What's steady like?
Steady is the supportive, friendly person. They tend to be informal. They are similar to the influential in that they like being around people. They're very much about team. They're very loyal as an employee. They're the very loyal individuals. Now, under pressure, they may give in, especially if they're dealing with someone like a dominant or an influential style who tend to be overpowering and loud. And then in extreme behavior, they get hurt, maybe even a little victim-y. They might even get accusatory because they're so hurt. They tend to avoid confrontation.
And the conscientious?
Conscientious is, you know, another way of putting it, they're the analyzer. They're very careful. They're quiet. Under pressure, they can become indecisive. Extreme behavior, they can get very critical. What's great about a conscientious style is they are the ones who will dot all the I's and cross all the T's. They're the detailed person. One of the things that in a workplace, what I'm often looking to do with clients is to say, okay, what styles do you have in your office? What styles are missing? And team them up together. So when I'm hiring an assistant, for example, knowing that I have a dominant style, well, I want someone who's either a steady style or a conscientious style. They're going to calm me down for starters. They've got they're a little more methodical. The conscientious person is detailed, so they're going to fill in the blanks. They're going to dot my I's and T's that I forgot to. So that's important. What happens many times is we hire the same kind of person. So as a dominant, if I'm not aware that I'm dominant, I'm going to be attracted to you. I'm going to hire Armand. So now we have two dominant people who are not dotting I's and crossing T's.
So you've got to have somebody around who's going to do that. And a balance in a place makes you work together. And then a balance inside yourself makes you work even better.
Right.
So when a person shows up, for possible vocational world, possibly having a job for life. You want them to bring in their styles, but you want their styles not to be painted all over their face, right?
Correct.
You want each of these styles to be there. So if you're a dominant, you don't want to be a loudmouth.
Right.
If you're influential, you don't want to oversell.
Right.
If you're steady, you want to still be able to talk.
Right.
No, but it's not the steady. The conscientious is barely communicates, right?
Right.
You want to have some communication in there. And those areas that you would train people, when you work with people to actually get them to change these parts of themselves, Nick, I mean, what do? Do you say, here's an example of when you were hurt and you became over conscientious and you lost contact with these people? And
right.
Is that what you do? What do you do?
Yes. What happens is we, you know, through a series of conversations and assessments, we determine what style you are. Right. And you put the mirror up and you can look and see how that style is serving you well and where that may be getting in your way. And so we then talk about, okay, the places where it's getting in your way, what are some ways that we can shift? Again, keeping to your authenticity of being a conscientious person, if we're using that as the example. But again, knowing that in every relationship, not everyone you're going to communicate with or relate to are conscientious people. So knowing that it's important to bring what's wanted and needed to a relationship that has a differing style than yours. I think that's really important. That's not being inauthentic. That's actually being authentic in that you're saying, I really want to connect with you. I really want you to understand what I'm saying, or I really want to understand what you're saying. We both have a common goal. Let me allow you to be your dominant self, let's say, and let me be my conscientious self. And together, let's use both of our strengths and what's in our gifts and what's great about our styles and create something beautiful, as opposed to butting heads.
Well, you know, you're a perfect parent. In a way, you are. You're a perfect parent. This is exactly what we wish our parents could have done.
Right.
Right? And so, in a way, you ever think about having a baby?
Well, funny you should say that.
Why?
Well, I have a 2-year-old. He just turned 2 about a week ago.
Yeah. What's it like showing him styles? Looking at the way he communicates, what's that like?
Oh, it's beautiful. It's beautiful. But it's also a reminder. He's very fiery. He at this point at 2 years old, is, I would call him a dominant. My wife and I, one month after he was born, wrote on a piece of paper, had it face down, and wrote down what would be one word we would describe him as. And we both put the paper down. Then we shared our answer with each other, and it was determined. We both had the same word. And, you know, what I think is important here is not to box someone in, right? So just because my son Elias is determined and fiery is not to just box him in that way, because he's also very loving, and he's also very attentive, and he's just a beautiful kid.
So you, after having taught so many people so many years, you get this magical chance to see it actually appear in front of your eyes like a bubble that grows.
Right.
You know? It's really beautiful, isn't it?
It is. It is.
My guest is Nick Papadopoulos. If you can't stay with us, he has a website called SkyesTheLimitCorp.com. SkyesTheLimitCorp.com, because Nick believes the sky's the limit. We're going to take a short break, play with a little music. When we come back, more with Nick and some other people to show you more about the possible job world and what you can do out there. We'll be right back.
We may not have a cent to pay the rent, but we're going to make it. I know we will. We may have to eat beans every day, but we're going to make it. I know we will.
And if a job it's hard to find, and we have to stand in the welfare line. I've got your love, and you know you've got mine.
So we're gonna make it, I know we will. We may not have a home to call our own, but we're gonna make it, I know we will. We may have to fight hardships alone, but we're gonna make it. I know we will.
Our car may be old, our children's cold, but we're gonna make it. I know we will. We may not can spare a road to crumb, but we're gonna make it. I know we will.
And if I have to carry around a fine singer, get the deaf, the dumb, and the blind, I've got your love, and you know you got mine.
That's a little Milton. We're going to make it. That's a good thing nowadays to remind people. Is it a crazier time than usual? Is the weather crazier than it's always been? Are people a little nuttier than they've always been? I don't know. Every time I meet people, they look at me and they say, aren't people nuttier than they've ever been? Or isn't the weather worse? I'm not sure. It all looks the same to me. We're talking with Nick Papadopoulos, who's talking about work. And here we are with this incredibly high unemployment rate in a country that seems to be falling apart, or we'd like to be convinced that it's falling apart because we have a black Democratic president. The truth is really not something that we could find. However, what we could do is find the truth inside ourselves. And the question becomes, how do you get to a place where you could work, do employment, get out there, be part of something, and still be authentic inside yourself? One of the things I promised myself when I was younger was that I would only work in a place where I could love everybody who worked there. And what I did was sacrifice a great number of things, sacrifice a lot of financial success, so that I could have a place where I loved it. So I love coming to work. I love the people who work here. I love what I do. But I gave up network television. I gave up a bunch of things that just didn't feel right, because it would mean I'd have to be somebody else. That's tough to do. If you got to support a family, that's tough to do. If you don't have food for the table, it's tough to do. Sometimes you got to eat crow. You know, not always nice. Nick Papadopoulos is with us, and he's not an idealist. Nick has worked with NFTE, haven't you, Nick? They're quite an organization.
Correct.
What are they about?
It's a high school program through the Board of Education. It's targeted towards teenagers in high school who otherwise would not go to school, would drop out. And these are kids who have a high IQ for business, who are not don't necessarily follow the traditional track. So they created this entrepreneurial program. And I go into schools here in the city, Westchester, Connecticut, and talk with these individuals. They're amazing. I mean, they're so amazing. It's great to see young people believe in themselves, get jazzed up and passionate around a product. Even if they don't have all the knowledge yet, what they have is heart. And they have a vision, and they have, and they have each other. Mm-hmm. And so it's great. It's great to be in their space and to be able to share some of the tools and the techniques and strategies about how to grow a business. But these are young people who are in high school, who are building businesses.
Well, wouldn't it seem? I think you make a very important point there. They have each other as well. Wouldn't it seem that there should be places where people of like mind could gather and focus their attentions? Now, I know groups of people with people who've got a lot of money and a lot of success who get together. I know about those groups.
Right.
But is there a place, is there a way that a bunch of people who are trying to get their own picture of themselves, learn their own techniques, isn't there a group somewhere, or are there groups where people could focus on their work identity?
Yes, there are.
What are those?
There's a number of them. You know, that's an interesting point. When you are in the job search mode and you don't actually have a job, I think it's actually very important to get out of the house and connect with human beings. So networking events and networking groups are critical. If you go, for example, to meetup.com, Meetup is a portal that has, within the portal, there are different groups who meet up, literally. So if you're someone who likes technology or digital media, there's a digital media New York City group. And you go to the meetup.com site, you type in digital media club New York, and voila, you have a group that has about 400 or 500 people. And they have all kinds of information on their little portal. More importantly, they have events. And at these events are people. And people who can support you in your career development, can open doors. You know, I really believe, well, it's not even that I believe it because over 75% of jobs are actually awarded through networking, through referrals. There's another company called ExecuNet, who I've worked with a number of years, and their whole mission is to connect people, because they've found the same thing, which is over 75 to 80% of positions are secured through people you know. It's easier, number one, to do it that way rather than just applying anonymously on some website that goes into some black hole. The other thing about networking is it allows you to tap into that dream opportunity, like the one I described earlier with my client. He ended up finding out that a friend of his worked at this company and leveraged him to get, you know, to get to the right person, to send that email that ultimately landed him an interview, that landed him a second interview, and so on to an offer. So there are a number of groups out there. And the good news with the internet being so robust now, it's much easier to find those groups. And again, I'm using Meetup or ExecuNet as two different groups.
So being internet savvy seems to be critical at this point in life. You know, you can't really get by saying, I don't own a computer and I'm not going to buy one.
Correct. Yeah, and I think, you know, with social media, you know, Facebook and LinkedIn, LinkedIn is a great professional tool. It's, you know, it's the professional version of Facebook without the shenanigans and without all the pictures and all that. But it's really about, it's a place where people can connect. LinkedIn also has groups. To your point, these are virtual groups, so they're not physical networking groups, but they're virtual groups that all email each other, update each other. It's almost becomes a blog. So you can join a group. So if you're interested, again, I'm just using digital media or technology as an example, there are a number of groups on LinkedIn that you can connect to. And again, that opens up a whole new world that you would not have had prior to using technology.
One of the this is Armand DeMille with Linda Vanilla and Nick Papadopoulos, and we're talking about work as a worker, you know, but also many of you out there are people who are bosses. And you have work, and you have a little place, and you have to keep people going. I mean, this one of the most difficult things in the world is management, managing people, because you got to manage them. They work for you, but they bring all their home pressures to you. So I pulled out a little interesting thing for you to also hear, and Nick and I will talk to you about this.
Chip and management faculty of the Poynter Institute. Hello, everyone. I'm Jill Geisler. I head the leadership and management faculty of the Poynter Institute. Poynter is a nonprofit school for journalists and media leaders in St. Petersburg, Florida. Today, let's talk about what great bosses know about success. Now, as an employee, you knew what success was. It was being a star performer, setting records, and taking bows. When you move into management, instead of being the star, you're grooming them. Instead of setting records, you're setting the bar for others. And instead of taking those bows, you're giving applause and recognizing the people who report to you. Great bosses know that leadership is indeed success through others. It's much more than just getting things done and a focus on products. It's a focus on people. You know, it's truly rewarding the day you realize the satisfaction from saying to someone, I knew you could do it, especially if you're saying it to someone who's really accomplished something. and that person may have doubted his or her own capacity for excellence. But you might ask yourself, okay, with all this service to others, could it possibly cause me to sacrifice my own upward mobility? You know, I'm stepping out of the spotlight and letting it shine on others. My answer to that is no, you really shouldn't worry, provided you keep a couple of things in mind. You really need to make your supervisors aware of people's growth and success. And when you do that, just know that it reflects well on you. That's especially so if you're a person who has worked studiously to earn social capital in the organization, both before and while you're in management. Now, by social capital, I mean you have credibility and trust because you've shared your expertise widely across your organization. You're known for acting with integrity. You're trusted because you give appropriate credit and you take appropriate blame. People know that you live your values. And another important thing is that you work across boundaries. You're not the kind of manager who's really good to his or her own team members and doesn't care much about the success of others. You're always working across boundaries, and that builds your social capital. If you do that, you'll recognize that success through others will in fact be your victory as well. Now, I just want to remind you that if you like these podcasts, you can subscribe to them by going to iTunes and then to iTunes U and looking up What Great Bosses Know.
This is Armand DeMille with you with the Positive Mind. Well, Nick, there's a familiar voice, huh?
Absolutely. Jill is definitely an expert on media and journalism and working with those types of folks. Does a great job, and she's made some really great points.
About being on top, being a boss. You were going to ask a question about that, Linda?
Yes. I'd like to know, Nick, if I was a boss and I was feeling a little bit unmotivated and kind of up against the wall, I'm sure would seek your judgment and your expertise. But if I was to have you as a speaker with a few other managers or people in that position who do have people that they're overseeing, What kinds of tools would you give us?
Well, you know, Jill mentioned social capital, building social capital. And my philosophy, which I would impart on your team, would be to catch people doing the right thing, is to really bring that philosophy and way of being to your office, create that type of culture. When you catch people doing the right thing, it's very much like a bank account. You're making deposits in the relationship account.
What do you mean catching people doing the right thing? What do you mean? That's fascinating.
Well, literally catching them doing the right thing. You came early to this meeting. Thank you for coming early. You submitted that paperwork on time. Thank you for doing it. In fact, it's the really small things. And I use small, quote unquote, but they're huge. It's a way to build people up. If you want someone to do something over and over again, acknowledge it. Let them know that you've noticed. Most folks,
as opposed to walking in and finding the one thing to criticize.
Well, I was going to say most folks. That's what they. It's easier for us. We're sort of conditioned that way to find what's wrong and what's missing, and that's okay to do. By the way, that is important. If you've made enough deposits in the relationship account, where, Linda, I've said, great job, thanks for coming early, thanks for submitting the paperwork in, 3, 4, 5, 6 times I've made the deposit. Well, that one time that you didn't come on time to the meeting, I can now say, hey, Linda, what's going on? People react differently because they view you as consistent. He consistently catches me doing the right things. He will also address me and acknowledge when he thinks I could be different. And I think it's not so much catching you doing the wrong things. It's coming from a place of seeing you, the employee, in a higher place. You know, as a leader, I believe it's important that we see people in their highest potential. So when I do say to you, hey, you didn't come on time, it's not meant to be a judgment or a criticism. It's more about you're better than that. You know, look how it impacts you. Look at the consequence it has when you do that. You're bigger than that. You know, you almost deserve more than that. So give your, you know, do it for yourself and for your kids and for your employees. And it's coming from that place rather than you didn't come on time and pointing the finger in your face, because people do get resentful at that because they feel then there's nothing forwarding about that. It's forwarding to say to someone, I just see you in a higher place. You know, be on time. You know, I don't even have to say it then. If they know that
I'd go crazy. When his style, imagine Thelma, right, who does more good stuff than any human I ever met. You don't have to even ask her a question. She's got everything in order. I'd have to be every day, you know, thank you, Thelma, thank you this, thank you that, thank you this, thank you that, thank you this.
Well, here's a trick for you.
Well, go ahead and teach me.
Okay, I put 5 coins in my right pocket.
Yeah.
Now, maybe it's a little easier for a man, but we'll figure out how to handle the other gender. But I put 5 coins in my right pocket. And the objective is to take those 5 coins from my right pocket and put those 5 coins in my left pocket. I can only put a coin in the left pocket if I've acknowledged or complimented or caught someone doing the right thing. So really, all you've got to do is catch Thelma doing 5 great things throughout the day. So that's your quota for the day is 5.
Nick, that was well said. Let me get a nickel. Hold on. I'm going to get a nickel.
Wait a minute. A quarter, please.
A quarter, right. That's great.
What I hear here is so much encouragement. What I hear is a lot of positive reinforcement of when somebody is, as you say, so well, authentic and alive and well. So that it would be easier, I think, at that point, once you're encouraging the person and the person feels so acknowledged, that what you would come across would not be in any way a distraction,
right,
or a complaint, but rather, again, a reinforcement of what you've already acknowledged.
Correct.
Which is a very good positive enrichment.
When going for a job, you know, people are very sensitive to being brown-nosed.
Right.
Right? They don't want to hear you sucking up with compliments.
Right.
To the boss. You know, the boss is a little wary of that.
Right.
Is that what you avoid? Because if you go to somebody and say, oh, that's a beautiful suit you're wearing, you lose points for that.
Right. There's different ways to, let's use the word, compliment or acknowledge. Listening to someone is an acknowledgement.
Yeah.
That has very little to do with brown nosing. If I'm looking at you like I am Linda now, you know, eye to eye, and she's talking and I'm acknowledging and not interrupting, and she knows I listened to what she said, that I got what she said, that in itself is an opportunity to make a deposit in the relationship account with her. So it's not about saying, you know, I really like your blouse or the dress you're wearing, or it's just listening to people. You know, it's being with them. You know, as a leader, going back to authenticity, it's allowing people to be authentic, to be themselves, allow them to make a mistake, to take a risk without having this fear that they're going to be ridiculed or hurt or fired for that matter.
So few people are used to being considered important that, you know, to pay attention to someone and to feedback something you understand. But not feedback something that's an interpretation of what they do. So if a person comes to you and says, wasn't that storm terrible? You don't go back and say to them, oh, you get frightened easily.
Right.
You don't want to do that, you know.
Right.
But to hear, you know, oh, that must have been difficult for you.
Right.
Is a different way of hearing a person, and people love to be heard. Wasn't it Carnegie who said people just want to be able to talk about themselves?
It's true.
How to influence, how to win friends and influence people. Did you ever read that?
Absolutely. That's my favorite book, How to Win Friends and Influence People.
What's the basis of the book?
It's interesting. It's so simple. It's ask questions, listen, be interested versus be interesting. It's really about making the other person the focal point. And all your attention is on them. And it's all about them rather than you. And when you take that approach, it does become about you as well, because the person becomes enrolled in you because they feel important, they feel wanted, they feel like you actually have their best interest in mind. It's a great book. I mean, it's a 70-year-old book, and 70, here we are.
70 years old.
And we're here talking about it because fundamentally it's a great way of being, which is outwardly focused rather than inwardly focused.
How long have you been doing this now?
Well, I would say all my life. I mean, professionally, as a coach, speaker, 10 years.
10 years.
But I've been leading people for 20 years.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like you've got that naturally born. What is the art of allowing?
The art of allowing is letting people be who they are and loving them for who they are. In fact, as opposed to, you know, often if you have someone with a dominant style, let's say I have the steady style, getting angry and upset that, oh my gosh, this dominant style is in my life, or vice versa, this steady style is in my life. The art of allowing is saying, be grateful for having this person in your life. It provides an opportunity to learn about yourself, because it's never about the other person. Any of those triggers, any of that discomfort that you're having, I believe it's about us. It's really about, you know, a relationship that we've had in the past that's unresolved, or judgment we may have about ourselves. So the art of allowing is really just saying, be okay with this person or this situation happening to you right now. In fact, look for the lessons. Be grateful for it. And don't try to change it. You know, don't try to change people. You can't be responsible for changing them. You can be responsible to people, but not about changing them. But just be grateful that it's happening. It's a lesson.
What do our reactions to each type tell us about ourselves?
Well, definitely it can be two things. One, it may be something we have judgment in ourselves. So it may be a mirror that, you know, I'm in a group with men who we get together, and often I notice when I get triggered or angry or upset, it's because it's something that I don't like in myself. That's where the judgment comes in. And I may cover up and say, oh, they're a steady style or they're an influential style, but really what it has to do is with me. It has to do with what shortcoming at least I believe I have. So I think that's one thing it says about us. The other is that sometimes it may be a style or reminds us of someone in our past that is triggering us. So, you know, for me, when one of my parents was very much had a steady style, and as I said, under pressure or extreme behavior, they get hurt and they get very accusatory and very victim-y. So when I confront that style, my experience of that kind of person immediately goes to, oh, they're going to act hurt. They're going to accuse me of something. They're going to be a victim without even giving them a chance. So I think it's really important to interrupt that thought that I have, interrupt my conversation with myself to say, just because this person has a steady style does not mean this is mom.
Sorry. Hey, Nick. Thank you very much for being with us. Nick Papadopoulos. The website, skiesthelimitcorp.com. He teaches people how to get the best out of themselves. And this will be available to you. If you want to play this for somebody else, go to the website. And we'll have, you can go to the archives, pick up today's show, and send it on to somebody. We will be back with you next Wednesday. Next Tuesday, they're doing a special event on WBAI, a report to the listeners, so we won't be there, but we will be with you on Wednesday. My friends, go to the Facebook, and you could send us an email as well at thepositivemind.com. Linda, thank you for being here. Nick, you're great.
Thanks. Thank you.
What is this?